Why would we do this?
Lawmakers take another look at the state's oil and gas tax structure. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 24th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a Homer pilot flies Haitian orphans to the United States.
All their parents were waiting for them when we got there, and we're so excited and relieved to see them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, schools, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
The Parnell administration agrees with legislative consultants who say under certain conditions, the state could lose money with a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets. But they counsel against changing the tax regime to remove the possibility. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
I'm not interested in rushing through this issue. This is the biggest issue sitting in this building by far.
Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman is prepared to get the issue of decoupling oil and gas taxes before legislators and the public. And Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin presented a series of tax scenarios that agree with Stedman's premise. If oil prices are high and gas prices are low, like they are now, and the two fuels remain linked in the current tax structure, the state will get a lot less money. Stedman puts the estimate at some $2 billion a year less that the state would receive than if they were taxed separately.
It looks like it takes away all our gas revenue on our severance portion, our production portion. Most likely takes away our royalty portion. And then we can get into finer calculations to see if we lose our property tax collection, that type of thing. But why would we not just shut the gate on the gas line? The Treasury would be up almost $1 billion a year without running. Why would we do this?
Galvin defends the possibility, however. He says by taking a risk on the price of gas, the state makes the project appear better to potential shippers and makes it more likely that there will be a gas line at all. In addition, he says, without the gas line, the money from higher production of oil will not likely be there. And the result could be even worse for the state's bottom line.
With the gas production, we end up with more oil production as well. And the projections for oil production without a gas line are different in terms of the oil side of this column than they are if you have gas in there as well.
Galvin says legislators should not look at revenue estimates as a snapshot. There's no legislation at this point for lawmakers to act on. However, there is a concern that decisions on separating oil and gas taxes be made before TransCanada goes to the industry for shippers to bid for space during the open season process beginning in May. By statute, a company willing to commit to the project may ship under the taxes in place at the time of the bid, locking in the state's position for 10 years from the time the gas line actually opens. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A handful of Alaskans were among thousands of fishermen who rallied today in the nation's capital. The recreational and commercial fishermen were protesting restrictions in federal fishing law designed to boost fish stocks but limit their catch. And they want more flexibility from the Obama administration when it comes to regulations. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Getting fishermen who fish for a living and those who fish for fun on the same page isn't always easy. But Wednesday's rally in Washington, D.C. did just that.
This is really just a wonderful, wonderful turnout. This is unprecedented for fishermen.
Tina Jackson of Rhode Island is president of a newly formed grassroots group, the American Alliance of Fishermen and Their Communities. She says among her peers back home, there's not always organized cooperation.
The competitiveness really drives a wedge between a lot of us. I mean, you know, my boyfriend and I lobster during the summer and then we drag during the winter. And the competition between the lobsterman and the draggerman is really all still one and the same. You know, it's still a high competitive industry. But when you see wreck guys, lobster guys, commercial draggers, gill netters, and rod and reeler, everybody coming together, it really just shows that we can get something done.
Jackson was thrilled to find an Alaskan at the Washington rally, Rhonda Maker from Kodiak. Maker's long journey to D.C. earned her a few minutes on stage, where she offered to be a conduit for organizing.
So if anybody, I'm really trying to use this opportunity to create a better, stronger network between all of us, because I think that's really the biggest part is that we're not hooked up. They have a network and we don't.
Maker's singular obsession is catch shares, and she wanted to tell East Coast fishermen to fight against them.
I am here because I'm trying to lend my voice, our voice, to fight off this catch share virus that's sweeping our nation that no one wants to impose upon our whole country. The privatization of our natural resources.
Maker dislikes the way catch shares privatize the fish stock and says she wasn't able to get much of a share, so couldn't afford to keep a boat on the water with such limited prospects of bringing home fish. After telling her story, Maker was swarmed by East Coast fishermen eager to know more.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Paul Terrio fishes in Gloucester and Rockport, Massachusetts. He fears catch shares going into place this year will drop his potential catch dramatically from the 130,000 pounds of cod he caught last year to a limit of 22,000.
I'm not going to be able to catch enough fish to maintain the boat and make the payments, much less feed my family. I'm scared to death. That's why I'm here.
The fishermen gathered in Washington had a wide net of concerns, but the rally's organizers hope they'll support bills currently in the House and Senate that would loosen the time period for rebuilding some overfished areas. They say more flexibility and putting off some deadlines can keep the fish coming in.
What if we can make enough noise applauding our industry that they can hear it over here in the Capitol and the buildings there? We can start applauding.
One of the rally's organizers, Jim Donofrio, is the executive director of the Recreational Fishing Alliance based in New Jersey.
Well, we have to get rid of arbitrary deadlines, and the arbitrary deadlines are causing these communities to be shut down. There's bad science on top of that, but when you have an arbitrary deadline, even if the science is good, you're going to be shut down.
The timelines to rebuild fisheries that Donofrio calls arbitrary, conservationists and federal officials call scientifically researched and carefully structured. They warn that loosening restrictions too much could lead to devastating crashes in fish stocks and harm the oceans. The man newly in charge of the federal National Marine Fisheries Service did attend the rally. Eric Schwab started his job this month, but Donofrio says he did not speak to the crowd.
I wanted to be proactive and not reactive. I didn't think it would be right for Eric to get booed off the stage. He's really a nice guy. We don't need to do that because he's only the cop right now. He's the deputy cop is what he is.
Schwab talked by phone with Kodiak reporter Jay Barrett of KMXT after the rally and said it was a chance for him to listen.
One of the things that we're trying to do, you know, and the councils around the country are trying to do is, you know, is work with fishermen within the existing statutory framework to employ whatever flexibility we can in the, you know, the implementation of some of these management programs.
Schwab says, bottom line, everyone wants the same thing, rebuilt sustainable fisheries. But the couple thousand fishermen at Wednesday's rally in D.C. had a basic message and chanted it to the Capitol across the street. I fish, I vote.
I fish, I vote. I fish, I vote.
In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Both of Alaska's U.S. senators voted for a $15 billion Democratic-led jobs bill this morning. It passed on a vote of 70 to 28. Senator Lisa Murkowski joined 12 other Republicans in supporting it. Murkowski had voted against moving the bill forward on Monday because she didn't like the tactics used by Democratic leadership to advance it, and she wanted to see a different version on the floor. But Murkowski voted for today's $15 billion bill anyway because she says she agrees with its basic elements.
Those four component pieces I am going to vote to support. I had really hoped that what we would have seen and been voting on this week was what Grassley and Baucus had negotiated. I've got a lot of folks in my state that are very, very concerned about some of the pension issues, and they really liked that little pension piece that was in there.
The bill that passed the Senate this morning includes tax breaks for small businesses and incentives for them to hire new employees. It also lets small businesses write off more new equipment purchases and boosts transportation funding for states. Senator Mark Begich voted both for the bill to advance on Monday and for its passage today.
It's exactly what some of us had advocated for, to keep the bill simple, keep it as a jobs agenda, focus on the first phase, which is small business protection, making sure we can grow our small business community, put more money into our transportation, which for Alaska means another $54 million this year.
Begich says this is just one phase of a broader jobs agenda he hopes the Senate will work on this year. The $15 billion jobs package now goes to the House. It voted to pass a far more massive employment bill late last year, but is expected to move forward on this version. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new internet radio station takes off in Southeast.
One of my goals is to give us one voice, hence the name Tribal Voice Radio.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A Homer pilot who found herself embroiled in Haitian bureaucracy and politics earlier this week has returned to the U.S. Stephanie Anderson, who normally flies for Smoky Bay Air in Homer but has been flying aid missions to Haiti for the last 3 weeks, got into a deepening mess last Friday when she agreed to fly a group of six Haitian orphans back to the U.S. after an angry mob accosted Anderson's group at the Port-au-Prince Airport Saturday, accusing them of trying to steal the children. The Haitian police detained Anderson's party. After being separated from the children for 2 days, Anderson's group was reunited with the children yesterday.
We went to the U.S. Embassy this morning, and they drove us to the airport through the back gate straight onto the tarmac, and where we waited for the flight, and did not get accosted by any mobs or arrested on the way, which was awesome. We had a smooth, uneventful, super fast flight to Florida. We got from Port-au-Prince to Miami in an hour and 45 minutes.
After clearing U.S. Customs, the children were introduced to their new families.
All their parents were waiting for them when we got there, and we're so excited and relieved to see them and hold them. And some of them meet them for the first time, even though they've been waiting for them and looking at pictures of them. And lately, even more pictures, watching them on the news.
Anderson says she plans to continue flying aid into Haiti. Timber industry and economic development officials in Southeast Alaska say they're disappointed with a federal judge's ruling last week over a court challenge to the 2008 Tongass Land Management Plan revision. U.S. District Judge John Bates ruled in favor of the U.S. Forest Service in a suit brought by the Southeast Conference. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
The Regional Economic Development Organization had argued that the plan's environmental protections were too restrictive under law and did not make enough timber available to meet market demand. Shelley Wright, Southeast Conference's executive director, says the lawsuit aimed to provide a reliable supply of timber to help Southeast communities.
A lot of these communities have been supported through the logging industry and through the efforts that they have put in as far as logging and getting the the payback from the government on those logging sales.
The conference challenged several specific elements of the plan, including its system of old growth reserves. The lawsuit called those protections for wildlife habitat a withdrawal from the Tongass's timber program. The group argued that such a designation needed the approval of Congress, just like a new wilderness area would. The group asserted that such withdrawals were specifically prohibited by ANILCA, the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Judge Bates ruled that old growth reserves are not a withdrawal. Rather, he cited multiple court rulings that found land use designations like old growth reserves are just part of the agency's responsibility to manage the forest for multiple uses. Attorney Tom Waldo with the environmental law firm Earth Justice calls the judge's decision important.
The timber industry and certain other interests in Alaska have long argued that this provision of ANILCA, which they call the No More Clause, prevents agencies from doing anything to protect wildlife and recreation and fish and other values on the national forests and other public lands in Alaska. That has always been a misreading of the statute, and it's great to have a court recognize that in a decision like this one today.
Waldo says the lawsuit would have made what he calls a bad forest plan even worse by opening more of the forest to logging. The lawsuit also challenged the forest plan's system for determining which timber lands are available for logging sales, but the judge dismissed those arguments. He also ruled against an argument that the Forest Service has instituted too many restraints on its timber program to allow it to meet timber market demand. The Southeast Conference's Wright says the decision does not make a big difference in how the Forest Service will implement its land management plan for the Tongass.
We were not trying to change the T-lump. Really, we were just trying to assist the Forest Service in implementing the T-lump, and we will continue to do that. We'll do what we can. We're working with the state, and hopefully we can get some more land for the state designation for some timber harvesting, and we'll just continue on and do the best we can for our communities in Southeast.
Wright says Southeast Conference will not appeal the decision. That does not mean the 2008 forest plan is free of litigation. Industry group, the Alaska Forest Association, has a separate legal challenge pending and now has to decide whether to go ahead with that lawsuit following the latest ruling. AFA Executive Director Owen Graham says he's disappointed the Southeast Conference challenge was not successful.
We still have the same problem as trying to get a timber supply from the Forest Service, and that's what that suit was about, and it failed, and so now we have to find some other way to try to help the Forest Service, you know, create a forest plan or implement the plan they've got in a way that will give us some timber, because right now our mills are starving. We only have one sawmill left operating, you know, of any size.
Graham says the organization's board will make a decision on their lawsuit at an upcoming meeting in March. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Department of Transportation is planning to build an airport for Acatan and open it by the fall of 2012. The $75 million facility will be built on neighboring Akun Island, and passengers will travel to and from the community on a hovercraft. Acatan Mayor Joe Bereskin explains that there was no good way to build the airport on Acatan itself.
Acatan Island is pretty mountainous. That's one of our problems we had, and there's only two sites that were recognized early on for possibility of an airport. The problem we ran into was having to build a road access to it.
Ahkoon, which is 7 miles away, is much flatter. Bereskin says they chose to use a hovercraft instead of a ship because it only requires landing pads instead of a dock. The Aleutians East Borough will pay for the operations and maintenance of the craft for at least the next 20 years. The project received priority funding from the federal government because the community doesn't have a land-based airport. Currently, the 90 residents of Akatown and the 1,000-plus employees of the Trident Fish Processing Plant travel to and from the island on an 8-seater Grumman Goose from Unalaska. However, no one manufactures parts for the aging World War II-era plane, so they are hard to maintain. The weather in Akatown makes it hard for other float planes to land there as well. Though the community is small, Trident's processing facility in Akatown is the second largest in the state. Judy Chapman from the state's Department of Transportation says the project is also important because it will provide safer and faster medevacs. Its runway will be long enough for the Saab 34Bs to land too, which will help Unalaska.
And so, you know, if there's a weather situation or some event where, you know, the Saab can't get into Dutch, it would have the option of going, you know, doing a short hop over to Akatown if the weather's clear there, and waiting a little bit to get back into Dutch rather than returning, you know, all the way to Cold Bay or Anchorage like it does now.
The airport will be the first in the nation to be put out for design-built proposals. A new report from the State Labor Department analyzes how much migration is taking place from Alaska rural communities to cities, particularly Anchorage, and who is migrating. Mike Mason reports from member station KDLG in Dillingham.
The migration of people from the bush to Anchorage and other population centers in Alaska has raised concerns about the impacts to the villages and cities where the people left from and the larger cities where they end up. The article specifically looks at the migration from what are called majority native areas. The data shows a gradual migration that Department of Labor Commissioner Click Bishop says equates to about 1% net population loss each year. The new study specifically looked at the migration in and out of 8 areas, which are labeled in the article as majority native areas. But the article asserts that a large share of the movement to Anchorage is from larger rural hubs like Dillingham and Barrow, where the native percentage is thought to be slightly lower than the majority native areas as a whole. That means that the estimate of movement from the majority native areas includes about 30% non-native residents. The new article observed that the movement from the majority native areas to Anchorage declined from 2000 to 2004, but it has increased since 2004 to about 1.4 thousand people each year in 2008 and 2009. The report further notes that the movement from Anchorage back to the majority native areas has remained fairly stable at about 800 people a year. If you crunch those numbers, it means that Anchorage has gained no more than 600 people each year from the majority native areas between 2000 and 2009. The author of the article is state demographer Greg Williams, who suggested that the under 20 population of the majority native areas is rapidly growing. He wrote that without a similar rapid growth in jobs and training opportunities following high school, there's strong pressure for young people, individuals, and families to move out of the state's rural communities. Some of the reasons given are to pursue jobs, post-secondary training, or military service. The data shows that about 70% of the people who moved from the majority native areas to Anchorage were under the age of 35, and about a third of those people were made up of those between the ages of 20 to 29 and children under 5. The data shows little migration of people over the age of 65. Another interesting bit of information is that more young women move from the majority native areas to Anchorage than men do. The author of the article says one of the reasons why is that more women pursue post-secondary education, and enrollment of Native women at the University of Alaska Anchorage has been about twice that of Native men. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A new internet radio station dedicated to Southeast Native cultures began streaming this month. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the station provides Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian education and cultural content.
TribalVoiceRadio.com.
The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribes of Alaska launched the online radio station Tribal Voice Radio on February 15th. Radio program coordinator Simon Roberts says the station is meant to connect Native residents of Southeast and beyond.
One of my goals is to give us one voice, hence the name Tribal Voice Radio, so we could become one voice. All of us could speak out with our cultural reps in each one of the communities. If somebody has a story they'd like to tell or any current Native events going on, they could contact us and we would have our cultural rep get a hold of that individual and they could tell their story or tell their news of what's going on within their area.
To that end, Robert says the Central Council is sending recording equipment to individuals throughout the region.
Right now we're up to, I believe, 8 handheld recorders that we sent out to all the various communities in the Southeast, and we even have a Seattle culture rep with a recorder.
The online station operates 24 hours a day. The station offers Native music shows as well as a number of talk shows like Elder Esteemed, Tlingit Corner, and the nationally syndicated show Native America Calling. Robert says a large number of the station's programs also seek to educate listeners on the region's native languages.
Even though we have universities teaching it, we'd like to be able to teach those who aren't going to school as well, because we feel the language is something that should be available for all. And so that's what we're pushing for, having Tlingit Word of the Week, having our language sessions every day.
Roberts did not have daily listenership totals for the news station. He says the highest volume of listeners are in the U.S., Canada, and Germany. The station is primarily funded by the Central Council, but is also soliciting grant funding and donations. Roberts says he has been working on the internet radio station since July of last year. He says the Central Council had been looking at opening an FM station for years and still hopes to open a non-commercial FM station in Juneau within a year. The Central Council must first obtain an FCC license before launching the FM station. The online radio station can be found at www.tribalvoiceradio.com. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. This message sponsored by ANSEP. The Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Sign up to participate in one of our information sessions to be held the week of January 25th by calling 297-2827 or visit rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.